An Orange County jury on Friday, September 23rd, found 10 of the so-called Irvine 11 students guilty of disrupting a public meeting and conspiring to disrupt a public meeting. The misdemeanor charges were brought over their actions during a speech by Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren on the campus of UC Irvine in 2010. Members of the Muslim Student Union stood up one after the other during the speech, interrupting Ambassador Oren from speaking, and walked out, only to be arrested. UC Irvine's administration disciplined the Muslim Student Union by suspending its charter for one quarter and placing it on probation for 2 years, even though they maintained that they as a group did not organize the action. However, Orange County District Attorney Tony Rakakis picked up the case as a criminal matter, charging the individual students with conspiring to commit a crime. The case attracted national attention, and many people, including some who disagree with the students' tactics, say the DA and the jury violated the students' right to freedom of speech. However, UC Irvine's law school dean, Irvin Chemerinsky, who specializes in constitutional law and has even represented detainees held at Guantanamo, said in a recent LA Times op-ed, quote, "Freedom of speech on campuses and elsewhere is rendered meaningless if speakers can be shouted down by those who disagree." And that, quote, "those who yelled to keep the ambassador from being heard were not engaged in constitutionally protected behavior." However, another UCI professor, Ray Tereda, who has taught courses on the customs and practices of campus protests, said the moderators of Oren's speech did not have the authority to lay out ground rules for politeness and decorum at the outset of the event, and that the student method of protest is a common one. The case of the Irvine 11 has been seen as a test of how far students can go in their on-campus protest actions, and also a test of racial and religious discrimination faced by Muslim students on campuses. The 10 UC Irvine students faced up to a year in prison, but ended up being sentenced to 56 hours of community service, fines, and probation. Joining me in studio now are two members of the Irvine 11, Usama Shabaik and Tahir Herzallah. This is the first time that they've sat down to tell their story to the media. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, I would have loved to have talked to you before you were sentenced, before the verdict happened, but there was a gag order placed on all 10 or 11 of you and anyone really involved in the case, which can be common, at least for those who are directly the defendants, but for anybody involved in the case to speak about it, how common was the gag order itself, or how unusual was it, rather?
Well, this technically is my first time in court, but the judge did make the comment that he did not want this to turn into a media warfare where both sides are kind of going at it in the media. And in a sense, I think that hampered our ability also to get out our message as the activists that had gone and protested Michael Oren. We were always hindered in our ability to actually, you know, say why did we do this, and what was the reasoning behind our actions.
And even like your family members?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go back to what happened before we get into the whole case. You guys have not really been able to publicly tell your story up until this week. I'd like to hear your description of how you planned the action against Michael Oren when he was giving his speech, because you've been convicted of conspiring to disrupt his speech. How did it all start?
Well, we received word in late January, I believe, that Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, would be coming to the University of California, Irvine, where I go to school, actually. And so we, as students, as a wide body of students, honestly, were extremely concerned at the fact that someone who has been nearly convicted of war crimes, the United Nations has come out against the Israeli attack and bombardment upon Gaza, and has said that what's going on is war crimes. And so as students of conscience, as students who are concerned that the university would allow and would sponsor this type of an event, more so definitely concerned us. So we got together and we planned, and we said we're going to do a protest because that's what college students do. We protest and we make our voice heard.
And you, when you say we, you mean you as individuals, not you as the Muslim Student Union?
Yeah, it was definitely individuals who did it. And this kind of nuanced discussion of MSU versus individuals and this concept of, oh, you guys lied about it. We never lied about planning the event or planning the protest. What we did was made a clear decision that this is not being put on. We're not protesting as an MSU.
Right,
we're just protesting.
You didn't put out a leaflet.
I was the vice president of MSU at that time. I didn't go to the protest as the vice president of MSU. I went as Usama Shabaik, and I'm going to show my opposition to what Michael Oren has done in the Gaza Strip.
Mm. Would you like to add anything to that, guys?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from UC Riverside, so I just got in contact with some of the guys at UCI, and they informed me of the ambassador coming to speak. So I decided to try and take part in any protest that would happen, and I just went there.
You went as a UC Riverside student, not even as a UCI student.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't have any access to any of the emails or anything like that that they presented in court.
And yet, you were one of the 10 who faced all of these.
Right. Yeah, and charges. I was charged with conspiracy as well.
Hmm. All right. Well, I want to ask you about what you thought the consequences would be before it all happened. When you went up, when you did the action, standing up one after the other, you shouted accusations of Michael Oren being a war criminal. What did you think would happen to you?
Honestly, none of us, I think, imagined it to get to where it is today.
Yeah, I don't think any of us thought that the district attorney would file grand jury subpoenas, mm-hmm. Harass students, investigate, and really go after students for a few months in order to have people testify. And really drag the case on for 19 months. I don't think anyone expected that.
Well, did you think that the campus police would arrest you?
I thought the campus police would escort us out of the room. I did not expect them to arrest us because I didn't feel that they had any grounds for arresting us. They just could take us out of the room and end it there.
Even a few months before, the UCs were going into like almost chaos over the whole tuition hikes that were taking place. And I remember in November of that year, actually, we had some crazy protests at UCI where students would go into classrooms and police were following behind them. And they would go into the classroom and completely disrupt the classroom, walk out, walk out, walk out. And even one student got into a shoving match with a professor on stage. And we're talking about like 500-person classrooms. Completely, there was no classes like going on at that time. But administration,
nobody got arrested. Nobody got arrested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, police were there, administration was there, and they were just letting it be.
So we figured that our protests would.
Yeah, it was.
It was not abnormal.
So it's a
anymore.
Common occurrence on campuses to do this kind of protest.
Exactly. And that was actual lectures, professors lecturing. This was a political event that was occurring on campus, the Michael Oren incident. Mm.
Well, Irvin Chemerinsky, who is the UC Irvine dean of the law school there, has said that what you did not represent freedom of speech because freedom of speech, quote, is rendered meaningless if speakers can be shouted down by those who disagree. He said those who yelled to keep the ambassador from being heard were not engaged in constitutionally protected behavior. He's a constitutional lawyer, and he's basically saying that even though he disagrees with the vehemence that Tony Rakakis went after you guys with, that technically your speech was not protected.
I think Irvin Chemerinsky is contradicting some of the previous statements that he made in the past, like in his entire history of being a constitutional lawyer. Hmm. I don't even know if he watched the entire video because Michael Oren was able to complete his speech ultimately, and our protests lasted for a small segment of the program. And we walked out eventually. We didn't necessarily shut down the entire speech. We protested, we made our remarks, and we walked out. So the entire event was not completely disrupted. So I think when Irvin Chemerinsky makes these kinds of statements, he's going on the assumption of what the 10-minute video or the few clips that he maybe has seen. It would be a good question to ask him if he's watched the entire video.
Well, there's a question of the practice of protests in the form of civil disobedience, and then there's the sort of the way in which these things are pursued by the law. When a group of people goes and sits down in the middle of the road to block traffic, they know they're breaking the law. In fact, that's the point. They know that they're doing a disruptive action because they want to call attention to their cause. Sometimes, as in the case, in fact, in Los Angeles recently, sometimes the district attorney of a city will go after people to make an example of them. Mm-hmm. To discourage that political speech or that political action, those sorts of tactics. So there's one thing to have the laws on the books, but generally those laws aren't enforced because it's an accepted understanding that these are political actions that should be protected. Is that the kind of basis for your defense?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that civil disobedience in its nature is meant to challenge the status quo. If somebody tells you, if the people that want to maintain the status quo tell you how to protest, then that means you're protesting within the boundaries that they've set for you. And that means you're not really challenging the status quo anymore. You're just going along with what they're giving you. So even with our what we've been charged with, California Penal Code 403, that has been enforced, I think, twice in the entire history that it's been on in the law books.
So you knew there would be consequences. You didn't know how far those consequences would
lead. Exactly. Since we realized that the DA didn't really prosecute anybody before, we didn't think that he would prosecute us now, especially considering the norms and customs and usage of the type of protest that we did before.
Even if you look at the emails themselves that were used in evidence, it clearly says within it, oh, if you do get arrested, don't worry about it. It'll go to the courts and they'll throw it out because this is First Amendment rights. My entire life, I have seen protest after protest after protest on college campuses where students would stand up and yell at a speaker and then leave. And never once did I see anyone arrested, prosecuted. And as I explained, even with the tuition hike protests, this is what happens on college campuses.
Why were you accusing Michael Oren of being a war criminal? Let's talk about what motivated you, because often in the media circus that happened around this case, the reasons why you guys were protesting weren't explored. I understand at least one of the Irvine 11 had family members who were killed in Gaza by the Israeli forces.
And it's very clear, and we know that Michael Oren was an IDF spokesperson during the Gaza War. We know that he actively participated in the military strategy. So he has a long history of being involved in the Israeli forces, especially in Lebanon in 82. So he's been actively participating in the genocidal policies of the state of Israel. And we knew that. We knew that coming in. What angered us the most is that the university sponsored this guy to come and speak on our campus. And they expected people that have family that have died in Gaza due to Oren's actions not to say anything. They expected those students to just come and listen and ask questions. And I think that's what's ridiculous.
I actually had the ability to go to Gaza the summer after the bombardment upon Gaza. And I was able to go into the Gaza Strip, and I was able to see firsthand what had occurred in the Gaza Strip.
Thousands of people were killed, including hundreds of children.
Yeah, 1,400 civilians were killed. And I remember vividly every single building, house, mosque, school was either riddled with bullet holes or completely destroyed. And we're talking about on the second story of houses around the windows. You're seeing windows completely riddled with bullet holes on every single house. I mean, don't tell me there's militants in every single house.
And so that's what motivated you to take this risk.
Yeah, and I even met three girls who had lost, three teenage girls. They had lost all their members of their family, 45 members of their family in one bomb that was dropped on their house. So, of course, I mean,
understanding the reality on the ground, we couldn't just sit there and stay quiet.
I'm speaking with Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah, two of the Irvine 11. They have not had the chance to speak out about what happened to them, the case around them, until this week. So let's talk about the way in which you and your families dealt with this whole debacle, this whole saga of you being prosecuted by the district attorney, the case as it played out. You weren't able to give your side of the story. How did you handle it? I mean, presumably you were still in school when it all started, and you still are.
Yeah. The night that we got arrested, I remember I went home late that night. I think it was around 1 a.m. And I came home and my brothers...
The night of the action.
Yeah, my brothers were giving me a round of applause. My mom was a little bit worried, but my dad understood, you know, that I needed to stand on principle and take action. So my family has been very supportive throughout the process. Sure, there was some worry about what kind of things could happen to me.
You faced up to a year in prison. Sentenced for up to a year in prison.
Yeah, I could have been sentenced to up to a year in prison, and so that worried my mother a little bit. But ultimately, they were very supportive. They understood that, you know, what needs to be done needs to be done.
And Osama?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, as any parent would feel for their child, they're worried and they stress out a little bit about their child and the consequences that he could face. But at the end of the day, I think that they were proud of the fact that regardless of the consequences, that if an injustice is taking place, that at least you have the courage to stand up and speak out towards that injustice. And really, I mean, just to kind of even paraphrase it, I mean, I don't really think we think of ourselves as heroes. We didn't do anything out of the ordinary. We do what college kids normally do. But for some reason, we got prosecuted.
Well, let's talk about what those reasons might be. You guys are all Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You are brown-skinned. Yeah. Your name is Osama.
Yeah, which came up a lot during the trial.
And do you think that all of that played a major role?
Definitely. I mean, what would motivate the district attorney to take on a case that he himself filed as a misdemeanor? That's a disruption protest. There's been many protests before. What would motivate him to take this kind of case? Who put this case on his desk and told him, you need to prosecute these guys and make an example of them? So these are the questions that linger in a lot of people's heads. And I think it's important for us to realize as a community that there are external pressures on political figures, especially somebody like the district attorney, to silence speech when it comes to Israel. When it comes to criticism of Israel, they want to make an example of us to say, look, if you do this, this is what's going to happen to you.
And even if you look at the rhetoric that Tony Rakakis and his office has been using for the past year and a half, in the beginning they likened us towards the KKK, saying all we were doing was just spewing hate speech. And I mean, with all due respect, I think Michael Oren propagating murder is not an expression of free speech, which is what I said. That's not hate speech. I'm calling for peace, and I'm calling for a stop to violence. And then even now, he is still so focused on the case. He recently published an op-ed, I think the other day, where he said, we will not allow a small group of people to hijack our freedoms. I mean, what are you trying to insinuate with a comment like that?
He's implicitly stating that, you know, he's using the common or like the Islamophobia that exists in our communities.
Definitely loaded rhetoric.
To try to instigate people to think of us as terrorists, ultimately.
I want to quote Susan Kang Schroeder, spokesperson for the OCDA's office. She told the LA Times that she felt that the defense supporters acted in an intimidating manner during the trial and that the students on trial were defiant after the verdict. She said, quote, they've shown absolutely no remorse for the fact that they committed a crime. How do you respond to that?
My response is, if standing up for justice, if standing up for truth, if giving a voice to the voiceless is a crime, then so be it. Call me a criminal. I'm not going to feel bad about that. And the judge even knew that we're not going to feel any remorse whatsoever for protesting. If the punitive system or the judicial system wants to make us feel bad for what we did, then they are not accomplishing anything.
One of our co-defendants, Asad Traina, he read a quote from Martin Luther King Jr. right afterwards during the press conference. And the quote, pretty much I'm paraphrasing, went along the lines of, most people walk out of a courthouse after they've been convicted with a crime, you know, sad, down, like they're down on their luck. But he's like, I'm walking out today with a smile on my face because I am proud of the so-called crime that I've committed.
And so she was expressing that you didn't show remorse because, of course, this whole trial and the case seems to be designed towards tamping down on the kinds of actions that you guys undertook. What effect has it had on your activism? Because generally speaking, one would imagine that any ordinary person that goes through this kind of experience may think twice about doing it again, may not want to go through what you've been through for over a year again.
It actually has invigorated, like, gives me more motivation to do work now. I'm taking part in a national Students for Justice in Palestine conference, and it's going to happen in New York in October. I'm actively involved in other organizations that advocate for the rights of the Palestinian people. I've actually feel more motivated now to, even more than ever now, to take part in protests, and I can't wait till the probation is over to get back right into it.
I think definitely we won't be silenced. This is in no way going to hinder our efforts in speaking out and speaking truth to power and really just trying to come up with a better society for all of us to live in.
Let's talk about what you were sentenced with. First of all, you didn't get sentenced to any prison time. Do you think that was a result of the outpouring of support that your case garnered among both free speech advocates and Palestinian rights advocates around the country?
Definitely.
That if it hadn't gotten the attention that it did, maybe that you might be sitting in prison today.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to tell what the judge is thinking in the back of his head. But I do have to say, with all due respect to Judge Peter J. Wilson, who was the residing judge over the case, he even made the comment that due to our outstanding character and the fact that we didn't act the way Tony Rakakis is trying to make it out, that we acted as thugs. Which he's used.
Wow. He called you thugs?
He called us, this is acts of thuggery, pretty much. He did say these are because of their outstanding character and because they were motivated by sincere beliefs. This does not warrant any prison time. Mm. So I do have to actually thank Judge Wilson for that. Mm.
And so it was 56 hours of community service, fines, you know, running upwards of $100, but then also probation. How long is the probation and what does it mean?
It's 3 years of informal probation, which the informal part pretty much means that a probation officer, you don't have to like check in with a probation officer. And then if we do our community service by January 31st, it goes down to a year of probation. And in pretty much just you can't commit any type of crime.
So if you're at a protest and there's cops around, then you have to really worry.
Make sure not to get arrested, basically.
Right. Yeah. So in some ways, it does restrict your ability to do political activism for the time being, at least for 1 to 2, 3 years, potentially. Mm-hmm. And how has it affected your education and your future careers? Because this is the kind of thing that can not only stress out somebody as you're studying for exams and doing homework, but also does it have any effect on your future careers?
I mean, as far as my education, since the event, actually my grades got better. I don't know about Osama, but my grades got much better. I've gotten straight A's for the past like 3 quarters. It's like, and professors kind of know me more now. But as far as career goes, I'm sure that, you know, it might have some effect on when you're applying for
what's
a job.
What's your major? And what?
Political science, international affairs. And I know so that if I'm applying for grad school or a job, you'd have to check that, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime?
Right.
So that might have an effect. But if they ask you what crime you've been, you know, convicted of, then I could just tell them. Mm.
And Osama?
I'm actually currently applying to law school. And I'm actually writing about it in my personal statement. So it's not like something
so
I'm trying to hide.
So you can use this as a way to get in.
Yeah, but
You've gotten an intimate understanding of constitutional law.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something now that has made me want to study constitutional law a little bit more to be able to better understand all the legal rhetoric that's being used throughout this entire case. And in terms of like future job opportunities and things like that, I think if it closes any doors in my life, then it was probably better for me to not have opened those doors to begin with. It's probably a job I wouldn't have wanted to have.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah, two of the 11 students who were charged with disrupting a meeting. The 10 were eventually convicted of disrupting a meeting, public meeting, as well as conspiring to disrupt a public meeting. And the gag order has finally been lifted now that the case has come to a close. And so they're joining us in studio to discuss how it all took place. Well, let's also talk a little bit about the local action around this case, because this all happened in Orange County, a county of contradictions in many ways, you know, home to very wealthy and often conservative people, not just in the population, but also elected officials, especially people who hold power. But then in the population, having a very diverse population, having an immigrant population. Do you think that the geographic context of what where your case took place played a major role?
Definitely.
Definitely.
No doubt about it. I think even the jury pool that we were faced with from the very beginning, there was just the fact that my name is Osama, and ironically enough, the case started nearly around the weekend of 9/11. Definitely.
The anniversary
of 9/11. Yeah, definitely, I think, could have possibly played a role. And the fact, I mean, if you look at any other university, look at the University of Chicago, where they did the exact same thing to Ehud Olmert, the prime minister of Israel at that time. Nothing happened to him.
So they also did a.
We actually styled our protest after their protest because we saw, okay, they're just getting escorted out by police. And they had, I think, almost 30 people
stand up one after the other.
One after the other.
And
absolutely no consequences, nothing. You look at all over the country, different universities, this happens every single day. But I guess we were singled out. And I guess the factor is this happened in Orange County.
And certainly it's a perfect storm of so many different things coming up, as you said. You know, the nature of the protest, the location, the university. What about the reaction on the campus of UCI? You're at UC Riverside, but Tahir and then Osama, you're at UCI. Was there campus awareness of this story, and did you get support, or did you also get attacked?
We definitely got support from the students, from a tremendous amount of students actually came out in support of us. And we did get a nice backlash from the administration.
From the administration. Was this student backlash?
There was from certain groups of students who are more pro-Zionist on campus. Definitely, they were offended by the protest that someone would come out against Michael Oren in this fashion. But from the activist students on campus, none whatsoever. They were very proud that something like this would happen at UCI.
In a way, it's put UCI on the map.
Yeah.
and then also from the local community in Orange County, there's a large Muslim population in Orange County. Did you find that this motivated a lot of folks to come out for the various rallies as well as at the court?
Definitely. I mean, the support that we've received from the Muslim community in Orange County has been amazing. It really strengthened us, and it motivated us to continue. And really just the organization and the way they came out in support, they came to the courthouse in huge numbers, to the point where there was people waiting outside to come and be seated.
In a 200-something person court, like the courtroom fits over 200 people, and there's still people waiting outside.
Packed.
Yeah,
and there's probably more people that wanted to come, but just decided not to because it was so packed.
And your supporters were described as intimidating by Susan Kang Schroeder.
If that's the case, I mean,
at one point in time, the audience, I guess, acted out of place for a courtroom because they clapped for one of the closing arguments. If that was the intimidating part, I can't really. I mean, I guess maybe for her that's intimidating.
But then again, we take whatever Susan Schroeder says with a grain of salt.
She's the one who likened us to the KKK.
Wow.
So
yeah.
She's not exactly the brightest star.
All right. Well, finally, any last thoughts to our listeners? The things that you'd like to leave this whole case with? I mean, this experience has probably been one of the most important ones of your lives, of your political lives at least.
I mean, what I have to say is that if the university, any university for that matter, decides to bring a speaker like Michael Oren, you better believe that students like us are going to be there, ready to protest, ready to do something. The state of Israel is committing grave violations of human rights and humanitarian law. And the people are starting to realize this, and they are not welcoming people who spew their propaganda and try to whitewash Israel's crimes.
And I guess also just to highlight one thing, because I've seen a lot in the media, is over the case of the 11th one of the Irvine 11 and what exactly happened with
right.
him.
Right. Let me just mention that this was the person who didn't get – he apparently finished his community service, right?
I'm actually not sure if he finished community service, but most people think that he took a plea bargain. What actually ended up happening was that the DA used privileged communications, which led to the judge actually dismissing three of the top attorneys from the district attorney's office, as well as the lead investigator from the case. And they used privileged communications between him and his attorneys in order to charge him. So once the judge said that was privileged, the DA said, you know what, we'll drop all the charges against you if you do community service.
Wow.
None of us got that offer.
Wasn't that 11th person did anything less than what you guys did?
No, he didn't plead guilty or anything.
They gave him an offer that none of us were given.
Yeah.
Because they violated the law.
Exactly. Yes.
Wow. So, Osama, you're going to go on to law. Has this eroded your faith at all in the legal system in the U.S.?
Honestly, the 2 day, or about, I think it was maybe like 2 days before our verdict was given, I heard the news of Troy Davis, and that was probably one of the most disheartening news I've heard in the past 2 years.
Were you following that case?
It was tough to follow because we were in court nearly all the time, no cell phones in court, anything, or internet. So it was tough to follow, but I was trying to keep up to date with it, and it was honestly heartbreaking. To see something like that happen, where someone where there's no physical evidence against him be executed and honestly murdered. And so definitely some of my faith in the justice system has been eroded, but it doesn't mean I'm gonna stop working for a better society, for a better justice system, working for people like Troy Davis, working for students who are no longer able to go to college because the UCs want to raise tuition to $20,000 within the next 4 years. I will not stay silent on issues like that whatsoever.
Well, I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us today, Osama Shabaik and Tahir Harzallah. Best of luck to the two of you.
Thank you
so
thank
much.
You. Thanks for having us.